You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. So information is changing by the moment as Brown County sees what is now the fastest growth rate in coronavirus cases in Wisconsin, outpacing Milwaukee County. The virus also killed a second county resident this week. The number of cases in the county jumped by over 600% in just 2 weeks. So what do you want to know about the spread, testing, symptoms, how ERs are caring for patients? We have physicians through the hour fielding your questions at 800-642-1234. Dr. Paul Casey is an emergency medicine specialist in Green Bay. He's medical director for Bellin Health Emergency Services. Dr. Casey, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So we're seeing in your neck of the woods, Green Bay, just experiencing this surge in patients. How are hospitals managing at this time?
Well, we've actually been relatively slow over the last month as people have followed the safer at home order, and some patients have been reluctant to even come to the emergency department with illness because they're afraid of catching the virus. So this past weekend, though, that totally changed with this little surge of activity we're seeing. As you mentioned, the volume has gone up 600% over the last week. And for example, we have a respiratory clinic that we try to direct most of our respiratory symptom patients there. On Friday, they saw 130 patients, where typically they were seeing in the 30 to 40 range per day. So the volume in the system is definitely surging upwards. In addition to the outpatients, we have more people being admitted over the past several days.
Do you have enough beds right now to deal with this surge?
Yes, absolutely. The reason for that is the hospital volume is down. This applies across the country. In order to prepare for this and keep people safe, we all hospitals in the across the country have canceled elective surgery. So a big percentage of our normal volume is related to elective surgery. So with that, we have plenty of beds currently. We have developed a specific unit for the COVID patients. We have 40 beds on that unit. Typically, 10 of those beds are occupied, or currently 10 of those beds are occupied.
Take us to the respiratory clinic. This is an outpatient clinic?
Yes, exactly.
Outpatient clinic. And so people who are having difficulty breathing, your patients would be referred there if it is not a situation where they would need to be hospitalized. Tell us the differences there.
So they're triaged over the phone by a skilled nurse who assesses the severity of their symptoms. Certainly anyone who expresses severe symptoms such as severe shortness of breath, if they sound short of breath over the phone, those patients are directed to the emergency department. Patients, typically when the illness first hits, symptoms are relatively mild. Sore throat, fever, sometimes a runny nose, and then a mild cough. As the disease progresses, it's typically days 7 through 10 when they get really, really sick. And so initially, when one first develops the viral infection, symptoms can be handled in a non-emergency department environment. And we try to cohort those patients. Most health systems do that for the protection of, number one, the staff, so we can limit the use of our PPE to one location. And then we also want to limit the spread to other patients who may be in the emergency department, although the risk of spread in the hospital is very low because we take very stringent protective measures.
We're talking with Dr. Paul Casey, an emergency medicine specialist in Green Bay for Bellin Health Emergency Services. You can join in. Do you have to go to the hospital routinely for something not related to the coronavirus? What concerns you about your future visits to the hospital? Has your ability to be seen by a doctor been compromised in any way? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Casey, at the respiratory outpatient clinic, what kind of services are being done there? What can a patient expect?
So essentially any service, it's actually one of our urgent care clinics that has been converted to solely respiratory illness. So they have the capability to test people for the COVID virus. They have the ability to do x-rays and basic laboratory tests. So any assessment that can typically be done in any urgent care center can be done at our respiratory clinic.
What personal protective equipment is needed right now at the hospital? How are you seeing your supply?
Our supply is currently very good. We're certainly not overstocked, but we have plenty of PPE to keep us all protected at current levels. If we see a huge surge in patients, that could change, but we're currently doing okay on PPE. We're being judicious, though, and so typically in respiratory season, when I see a patient with a respiratory illness, I put on a surgical mask and I throw it away immediately after that patient. We have changed that practice in order to conserve surgical masks, which are a high volume item. So typically I'm issued one mask at the beginning of my shift. I wear it all shift. I have a second type of mask called an N95. If I have a patient with an acute respiratory illness, I put that mask on because it offers a higher level of protection. And again, those masks typically are designed for single use. We are reusing those and have developed the capability to sanitize them. So we have enough supply as long as we manage it judiciously.
So you're stretching your supply and only using that N95 respirator mask when you need to, when you have a suspected case that is more critical than another case.
Exactly.
When a patient goes into the emergency room, what is the triage like now? How has triage changed?
So triage has changed substantially in that we moved our triage area outside the hospital or the emergency department entrance. We put a trailer out there. We blocked off the other entrance to patients. So all patients are funneled through a single triage tent. There's a nurse in a surgical mask who does the initial screening. The temperature is taken in the triage trailer, and the patient is masked. So the reason for that is we don't want people walking into a waiting room potentially having the virus. So we have a single patient in the triage trailer at a time, avoiding exposure to other patients who may be waiting to be seen.
How often are patients coming in by ambulance?
I worked over the weekend. We had three by ambulance when I worked. So not a high volume yet, because our population is certainly of the Green Bay proper, about 100,000 people. Compare that to millions of people in New York City. Our ambulance volume, just by the very nature of our population, is far less. But as a percentage, I think it's appropriate to the number of cases we're seeing.
And for the people who do come in by ambulance, what kind of condition are they in?
The ones who come by ambulance typically look sick. They are sweaty. They are short of breath. And we had one yesterday who came from the respiratory clinic who had what's called an oxygen saturation of 60%. So in a normal, you and I have an oxygen saturation of 95 to 100%. That tells the amount of oxygen in the bloodstream. In severely ill COVID patients, we see their oxygen saturation drop. And the interesting phenomenon is that a lot of these patients, actually, they look fine, but their oxygen saturation is 60%, which is a totally new presentation. I've been an ER doc 34 years, and I have never seen anything like this, where somebody can be awake, talking, and have an oxygen saturation of 60%. So we're learning about this disease and its different presentation. And that's why the initial response to treatment on these patients was immediate intubation.
Let's pause right there on intubation with emergency medicine specialist Paul Casey. He's medical director for Bellin Health Emergency Services in Green Bay. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Investigators from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, they arrived Monday in Brown County to look into the coronavirus spike in the Green Bay area. The county's environmental health manager told the Green Bay Press Gazette that the CDC is assisting with contact tracing to determine how many people were infected at the meatpacking plant JBS Packerland. What do you want to know about social distancing policies and how the virus is able to spread? What questions do you have about what it's like to treat patients in Wisconsin ERs? Be part of this at 800-642-1234. Dr. Paul Casey is an emergency medicine specialist in Green Bay, and he stays with us. Dr. Casey, Aaron from Oshkosh called in, couldn't stay with us, and Aaron asked if the surge in Green Bay is being seen across the Fox Valley, including Oshkosh. What do we know there?
I have not heard of a significant equivalent surge in Oshkosh, although I'm on a committee called the Hospital Emergency Response Council, and there are several regions across the state. Let me look here. I don't have that website at the, let's see.
And we can follow.
I can't find the link quickly.
That's
all
right.
I can't find the link quickly, but looking at the cases by county, ours is by far the third highest. So I've not seen a spike in other counties other than Dane and Milwaukee.
Judy from Ashland called in and asked if everyone with symptoms is being tested for COVID-19. At what point are people being tested, Dr. Casey?
So until just a little over a week ago, we were only testing. We had limitations on testing. Fortunately, about 7 to 10 days ago, we now have the capability to test everyone with even minor symptoms. So a month ago, we only had 8 labs in the state running tests. Now we have, I believe I wrote down, 36 labs able to do tests. So anybody with even minor symptoms is currently being tested in Brown County. And that's key to getting this under control, because we need to identify people who have minor symptoms who turn out to have COVID so we can appropriately isolate them and prevent them from spreading the disease.
And just following up on the question from Oshkosh, we just looked it up here, our producer saying that Department of Health Services figures show that Winnebago County, which is the home of Oshkosh, has 40 positive cases and 1 death. So a much lower rate per capita than Brown and Milwaukee.
Right.
Yeah.
We were in that same range a week ago. Ours went up exponentially over the weekend.
Do we know, and contact tracing is still happening, but did we know what set that off in Brown County? Is there any better idea?
Well, it's all personal contact. This disease is highly contagious. So you've probably heard the stories of, for example, a family in New Jersey who had a birthday party for the grandmother, matriarch of the family. 7 of that family got it, 4 of those died. So this is a testament to the highly contagious nature of this disease. If you put 20 people in the room, 18 of those people are going to get it. So, and patients can be highly contagious before they have symptoms. So if you go to a party or a densely packed store, even if you don't have symptoms, you can transmit this highly contagious disease to a bunch of other people who may or may not develop symptoms if they become infected.
We're talking with emergency medicine physician Paul Casey. He's medical director for Bellin Health Emergency Services in Green Bay. You can join in. Healthcare workers, what precautions are you taking? Do you feel they're adequate? What would you like the public to know about staying safe and slowing the spread? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. Casey, let's spend a bit here on ventilators. How successful are they in treating COVID-19?
So that's a very interesting question. Initially, when this pandemic started, the condition that was seen is called ARDS, or acute respiratory distress syndrome. Basically, the lungs fill with fluid, cause this whiteout appearance on an X-ray or CT scan. So the typical treatment for ARDS as a ventilator with something called PEEP, which is high pressure. So that's why early on, many patients were intubated very early on. That turned out to be the wrong strategy. And essentially, we now think putting somebody on a ventilator is almost a death sentence because it's a totally different, what we call medicine pathophysiology, or the process that the disease damages the lungs. So we have only intubated one out of 20 of our patients, which is the new strategy, and these patients are doing much better. So the initial thought that we would need thousands and thousands of ventilators turned out to not to be true. So we're learning as this disease process evolves.
So if not ventilators, what is the course being taken right now to treat these severely ill patients?
So it's called high flow oxygen. This disease causes a lack of oxygen, and not only does the virus specifically attach to cells in the part of the lung called the alveoli, the little air sacs, and cause damage to the membrane that results in gas exchange, it also binds to hemoglobin, which carries oxygen across the body. So there's a decreased ability to carry oxygen and a decreased ability for the lungs to take up oxygen when you breathe. So the solution to this is very, very high flow oxygen via non-ventilated means. So we have a stepwise approach. We start with what's called a nasal cannula, two little prongs under your nose. We dial that up to 6 liters a minute. If you remain with a low oxygen saturation, we go to the next step, which is high flow nasal cannula, a different device that can deliver up to 60 liters per minute. If you fail that, then we go to something called CPAP, which is stands for continuous positive airway pressure. That's a device that actually can add pressure to the high oxygen, and we very slowly dial up the pressure.
Many people use CPAPs at night to sleep.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and so this sounds like a less intrusive than a ventilator.
Yes, definitely.
And what type of results are you seeing as you move toward this type of treatment?
So at our hospital, we have not had a death. We have had our first intubated patient be extubated, meaning the ventilator was taken off yesterday. And we have discharged, I think, 6 or 8 patients. So far, the patients we have treated have done well. And we're not sure whether that's because they haven't progressed to that severe stage of disease called the cytokine storm, or whether it's due to the strategy that's now being applied to COVID patients of not intubating them early. And that's what many of us suspect, that our strategy of not putting people on a ventilator is actually producing better outcomes.
Before we have to let you go, the Food and Drug Administration had granted emergency use approval late last month for hydroxychloroquine to be distributed to hospitals around the country. What do you know there about the effectiveness of this anti-malaria drug?
So that's a very excellent question. There was much hype about this drug. We have been using it, but it's only with the caveat that the patient knows it's experimental and what's called off-label. It's not FDA-approved for treatment of this disease. And the two latest studies that came out show that it's not effective. And actually, the latest study showed there are actually more deaths. So there, a professor from the University of Wisconsin in Madison did a webinar the other day who said they stopped using it based on that data. So most places are using it, but we have to get the science, and the early science that's coming out is telling us that it's not effective for COVID pneumonia.
Convalescent plasma also been tested at Wisconsin hospitals. Do you see that these transfusions may be something in terms of patient care?
Absolutely. And I lead our inpatient guidelines team. Yesterday, our hematology specialist told us we now have convalescent serum available, so we're quickly incorporating that into our order sets, and there's been some positive data coming out about the use of the convalescent plasma. And that makes sense, because what this means is you get the disease, you develop antibodies to the disease, and then you use those antibodies to help fight the virus in somebody else's body. We use this for a couple other viral diseases. For example, if you're bitten by a bat and there's a concern about rabies, we give you what's called rabies immune globulin, which are essentially antibodies against the rabies virus to start attacking that virus if you were infected with it until the vaccine can build up inherent immunity. So there's promise to the plasma.
Dr. Casey, thank you so much for joining us.
You're quite welcome. My pleasure.
Dr. Paul Casey is an emergency medicine specialist in Green Bay. He's medical director for Bellin Health Emergency Services. Coming up, we have a family medicine specialist answering your questions about her efforts to help coordinate drive-through testing in Milwaukee County. Stay with us. There's more conversation ahead after this news update here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A big thank you to everyone who donated during our spring member drive last week. Support from people like Jean in Monona sustains the trusted news and information you value on the Ideas Network. To ensure the resources are in place, we do fundraising throughout the year, but the current situation is affecting that work. So if you missed the drive, your gift now at WPR.org is especially important, and thank you so much. Right now, we're talking with a family medicine specialist who, in recent weeks, has worked to get community COVID-19 testing off the ground. Meanwhile, Wisconsin is taking steps to increase testing capacity statewide. The state has increased the number of labs performing COVID-19 tests from 8 a month ago to 36 this week. What do you want to know about drive-through testing, antibodies, the efficacy of testing? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. Patricia Golden is an osteopathic physician at Ascension Medical Group with a family medicine practice in Franklin. She has led Ascension's efforts to open drive-through testing, create dedicated respiratory clinics, and expand virtual provider office visits. Dr. Golden, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate.
Take us back to last month when Ascension was preparing to launch drive-through testing. What did you do to get these sites ready to go to accept patients in their cars?
Sure, absolutely. So, thinking about where we were a month ago, it just seems like forever, where we basically within days were able to come together as a team across the state of Wisconsin and develop these testing tents that were critical for us to really truly understand this infection and how it was affecting all of our communities. So we brought together a team of nursing staff, our physician leaders. We brought together many of our operations directors. Our IT leaders were instrumental to helping us to develop these opportunities for all of our patients. And then in essence, what it really truly did was, we understood the necessity to keep our patients safe in addition to also keeping our associates within the clinics safe. So it was instrumental that we had many different ways to for patients to access us. If patients had some of their primary care clinics, they would call in and they'd speak to either the clinicians over the phone or they'd speak to their nurse triage and we'd go through the symptoms that originally had been depicted by the CDC. And if anyone fell into the category where we were concerned at that time that they needed to have testing done, we would place our orders and then deliver them to a certain location. And we strategically planned where these tents would be based on, the communities. We actually have 15 across the state of Wisconsin. 7 of them are predominantly here in the Southeast Wisconsin region. So, 15, so we would send. Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead. So you have 15 operating right now. Take us through that process. Yeah, as you were saying, I interrupted you.
Oh, sure. So again, you know, the patients would show up there, and I really appreciated all that Dr. Casey had mentioned previously. It was critical for us to. With the PPE shortage, so, you know, with our protective gear being in short supply, we knew we needed to really focus on where those gowns and the protective gear needed to be worn and try to eliminate that overuse in our other areas of our clinics. So we would send our patients there. We'd have our staff going out right up to the cars and doing the nasopharyngeal swab, which I'm sure many people have witnessed on the news. It's not a fun exam, but it was a critical exam. And we would obtain these tests in a really controlled and safe manner. We actually scheduled appointments to be going through the drive-through test because it was, again, really instrumental for us to keep that entire environment controlled so that we were not spreading this potential to the communities that we were doing the testing in.
So what was the volume then for testing, and what is it like now?
Right. So I know one of your callers had asked about the Fox Valley, and we actually have a couple of different sites in the Fox Valley set up. So we've been watching for the last several weeks the numbers, and they have definitely followed suit in that surge that we were happening at certain healthcare systems. And interestingly, exactly like the data you guys just reported, we have not had a massive surge in the Fox Valley. We had a very low percentage of positives, though we continued to test those that were appropriate for the symptoms. So in the in our seven here on the southeast side, though our testing continues, our numbers of positives have gone down from where they were even 2 weeks ago.
Where do you send the specimen for the lab work?
So for our tents as well as our respiratory clinics, we knew that it was important, again, that our most critical and most vulnerable patients, as well as the healthcare workers that were required to take care of our critically ill, those were the tests that went to the state lab as well as the city lab. Ours would go to outside laboratories, in which originally the turnaround time was a little bit slower. But those were the patients that we were having really close conversations with about, you know, their need to stay home, their need to have excellent respiratory hygiene. So we were trying to control all of those. And in addition, we were keeping in close contact with them, just making sure that they weren't decompensating and needed to be sent to our emergency departments. But the whole point of our testing tents, as well as our respiratory clinics, was really to work in conjunction with our hospital partners in trying to reduce the surge that was going towards their facilities and seeing what we could do to prevent and educate.
We're talking with Dr. Patricia Golden. She is an osteopathic physician with Ascension Medical Group affiliated with St. Francis Hospital in Milwaukee. You can join in with your questions about testing, about symptoms, about the protocols in place to treat COVID-19. Have you called your local physicians about concerns surrounding the coronavirus? What did you ask and what did they tell you? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Golden, do you have an adequate number of tests? And with turnaround time, you said it was taking a little longer. What type of time are you talking about? Is it hours or days?
Sure. So from a hospital standpoint, that's going to be a different conversation. Theirs are very quick turnarounds.
Okay.
Because we did not want to overburden the state or the city lab, as well as our own infrastructure. When we do send out to our outside lab sources, it's about a 24 to 48 hour turnaround time.
There's been debate about the efficacy of these tests. How reliable are they?
Well, so the nasopharyngeal tests that we do are, it's a PCR test. Those are, those, you know, have a higher predictive factor for us as clinicians. I think where we're learning right now is, you know, with the antibody testing and the different types of serum testing. So, you know, we're every day we're learning, and there's, you know, specific tests that are coming out that we're hoping to work in conjunction with the PCR nasal pharyngeal testing. And I think that, you know, will also start helping us determine, you know, how do we start relaxing a little bit on that physical distancing that we've really highly relied on to help protect our communities as well as our healthcare workers.
Will the different types of testing, do you see those being able to be delivered in a drive-through model?
The ease at which some of these serum tests can be done would definitely be an opportunity. I think that, you know, how we decide to use the serum tests will be an important factor on how we decide to do the testing. So at this point, for the antibody test, it's really, Kate, for us to determine if somebody has started building up immunity to the virus. So at this point, what we know is it's not a great predictor of who actively has the virus, but it's much better if we're able to see if they've built up immunity, which is, you know, then at that point, we could start looking at, you know, can we open the doors to those who are immune and, you know, they can go back into the workforce and not be actively spreading the disease. When we have positive nasal pharyngeal swabs, though, at this point, you know, we know it's a positive. We know either they actively have the disease, they could be shedding the disease. And that's when we're talking about kind of that asymptomatic positive. So they don't even have symptoms, but they're positive, which means that when they're out in the communities, though they don't have symptoms, or maybe their symptoms are so mild they're not recognizing it, they're also putting the rest of our community at risk for spread.
Yeah, we're talking about drive-through testing for COVID-19 with Dr. Patricia Golden of Ascension Medical Group as our guide. She has led Ascension's efforts to open drive-through testing, to create outpatient respiratory clinics, to expand virtual provider office visits. Have you done a drive-through test? What was your experience like? Did you prefer it to an office visit or going directly to the ER? Join in with your insights, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a moment. There's more conversation here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. More than 700 Wisconsin National Guard troops have mobilized to support the state's response to COVID-19. And we learned this week that the Health Services Department will have Guard members doing specimen collections at some COVID-19 mobile testing sites. We have family medicine specialist Patricia Golden of Ascension Medical Group who stays with us. She has led drive-through testing coordination at 15 sites for Ascension. Dr. Golden, we have Sandy from Milwaukee who called in, couldn't stay with us. Sandy wants to donate plasma, but they aren't sure if they have the antibodies that would be helpful. And Sandy wants to know how they could find out if they have COVID-19 antibodies. What do you think?
So that's a really interesting question. Right now, where we have been focusing on for our donations are the patients that we know have tested positive, and then they've gone through the course of of healing. So there's some fairly strict guidelines when it comes to donation and determining when would be an appropriate time for us to be able to utilize that plasma. So what I would recommend is that she would contact maybe her local either primary care office, where they can have a conversation with the hematologist, possibly that may be doing this type of study or work within her organization. I know for us, we have Dr. Jonathan Treisman, who's been just instrumental for us with the research going on with the donations and treatment with the plasma.
How long do you anticipate that you'll keep open your drive-through testing at Ascension? Do you have any timelines?
We actually are in the process of looking at where our future normal is going within medicine. But, you know, Kate, what I'd say is right now we know that the testing is really instrumental at giving us an accurate count for the infection. And when we have that, you know, we can start understanding the spread of COVID. We can start doing, we can conduct contact tracing so that we understand when we do have someone who tests positive, where has it potentially spread. This is also going to end up helping our public health departments in providing recommendations to the communities, you know, and then for us as well in the healthcare systems, it's going to help us kind of predict or prepare for when additional surges will happen, because what we're learning is, you know, this is not just a one and done. You know, I read a wonderful article that it basically described this as we're in about the second inning of a 9-inning baseball game. And so us continuing to have the ability and the resources for testing is going to be critical for us to be able to monitor and control this over the next, you know, 16 to 18 months. And, everything that we're doing now is going to help our healthcare systems, our scientists come up with immunizations and ways to reduce the amount of morbidity and mortality that is being predicted with this virus.
Do you feel like you could scale this model? Could you stand up more sites if you needed to?
Oh, absolutely. So one of the, if I were to come up with a positive from this event, it has been amazing for us to see the collaboration that's happened, you know, across our state, across our nation, with all the different healthcare systems. So currently, I've had the pleasure, and I've been working, you know, basically helping guide and share some of the lessons that we learned, as well as some of our best practices with the Milwaukee Healthcare Partnership, as well as the local FQHCs, as they're trying to stand up their own testing sites. And really just seeing that collaboration to protect our state and having that shared goal for healing our communities has absolutely been beautiful.
Well, Dr. Golden, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kate. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
Dr. Patricia Golden is an osteopathic physician with Ascension Medical Group affiliated with St. Francis Hospital in Milwaukee, and she's been leading Ascension's coordination of drive-through testing and respiratory care sites. Earlier, we talked with emergency medicine specialist Paul Casey of Green Bay. And now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a mother's tea.
Many of us grew up questioning our parents' methods and traditions, only to find ourselves embracing them later in life. That was definitely the case for Rita Yeolor. She tells us about the skepticism and love of her mother's tea.
When I would get sick, my mother would rummage through the cabinets, pulling out crinkled Ziploc bags filled with twisted roots that once clung to the earth, golden leaves touched by King Midas, and of course, the trusty old Chopaje. The Chopaje was our family's medicine rock, this white, clay-like crystal my mother would scrape into a powder before boiling it into a tasteless tea. Then she'd order me to drink and ask no questions. I had many. I drank anyway. My mother comes from a long line of healers. Her father was a shaman who traveled between both worlds. She is an herbalist who interprets dreams. I happen to be the skeptic of all things. When I was 8, I lost one of my front teeth. Months went by and still no tooth. How did you throw it away? My mother asked, because you see, there's a special way of disposing of one's tooth. If you lose a tooth along the top, you must hold the tooth up to your forehead and let it fall into the garbage. Our teeth at the top grow down, so the tooth must also go down. My mother did not witness how I had thrown the tooth away and became concerned. One day she said, "When we go to the garden, bring an apple." Across our garden was a grassy field, and in that field lived a horse. I was instructed to offer the apple to the horse and say, "Horsey, horsey, my tooth will not grow back. May I have one of your teeth, please?" Shortly after that, it grew back. I remained a skeptic. I was embarrassed by my mother's unconventional ways. Many times I demanded to see the label of her ingredients. My mother said her chua didn't come with labels. She would say, "Bei Meng Huli Na, we Hmong call it this." And this never seemed to have a good translation. For example, chua gu ta hao literally means medicine hot head. When you Google it, it pulls up hot flashes and menopause, which I don't think I was experiencing at 15. I refused to drink my mother's chua from then on. The following 10 years, I did what most everybody does. I went to the doctor. Sometimes I was told to go home and let things heal on their own, take some Advil, apply this cream, here some antibiotics. Something was always missing, though. I started to explore how others heal themselves and became fascinated with rocks, these everyday things that could be a billion years old. Imagine the stories they must hold. I wondered if that was what my mother thought when she untangled roots or collected leaves for another herbal concoction. During my rock phase, I learned about selenite, known as a healing stone. It's sometimes sold in thin, long slabs. I ordered one for myself, and when it arrived, I noticed it was soft, a bit dull, and somewhat chalky. That's when I realized I had seen this before, in my mother's kitchen. The trusty old chopaje, the tasteless tea I drank as a child, this was it, just in a different form. I was babysitting my nephew when he lost a tooth. He wanted to put it under his pillow for some tooth fairy money. "Bud," I said, "do you want tooth fairy money, or do you want your tooth to grow back?" There we stood in front of the garbage bin. Sometimes the universe has its way of leading you back to your mother's tea.
That story came to us from Yia Lore, a writer who lives in Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we explore how musicians are adapting to the coronavirus pandemic, making music that encourages social distancing and staying healthy. Stay with us. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. It's a cure for tonsillitis and for water.